Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Hearings today, General Michael Hayden, the man President Bush wants to head the CIA, is being questioned by members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. As director of the National Security Agency from 1999 to 2005, the Air Force General put in place and oversaw President Bush's warrantless surveillance program. The administration defends the program as an important tool to fight terrorism, while critics call it illegal and a threat to American civil liberties. Facing questions about the program, Hayden insisted it is legal. The general also pledged to balance the need for effective intelligence gathering with a respect for Americans' privacy.
I will draw a clear line between what we owe the American public by way of openness and what must remain secret in order for us to continue to do our job.
General Hayden also acknowledged a series of intelligence failures in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and promised to make needed reforms that would prevent more of those kind of mistakes. The first Democrat to question Hayden, Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, pressed him for answers on the limits of domestic surveillance. Levin wanted to know if the program stops with eavesdropping on international calls, as revealed by the New York Times last December, or whether the spying includes the collection of domestic phone records, as reported last week by USA Today.
Is that the only privacy concern in this program, the international phone calls?
Senator, I don't know how to answer your question. I've just answered that there are privacy concerns with everything that we do. Of course, we always balance privacy and security, and we do it within the law.
Is that the whole program?
Senator, I'm not at liberty to talk about that in open session.
I'm not asking what the program is. I'm just simply saying is what the president described publicly, the whole program.
Senator, all I'm at liberty to say in this session is what I was talking about. I am talking about the program the president discussed in mid-December.
And you're not able to tell us whether what the president described is the whole program?
No, sir. I'm not in open session.
That's General Michael Hayden sparring with Michigan Democratic Senator Carl Levin this morning. Joining us on the line from outside the hearing room is Mark Hosenball, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Mark, thanks for joining us.
How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Hayden seems like, from what I saw, he has a sort of folksy manner, an easy speaking style. He called some of the dust-ups over domestic surveillance furballs and said, we'll do our best to tell you what we know. What stood out to you so far in the hearing this morning?
Well, General Hayden is a very smart guy. He's very brainy. He's very good at briefing people. And it struck me that he's very well prepared, and he's telling the senators what he thinks that they want to hear, and it looks like that it is what they want to hear. So he seems to be doing pretty well at the moment.
Well, obviously, and as we were referring to in the introduction, one of the biggest and most contentious issues leading up to this hearing is the talk and debate about warrantless domestic surveillance. Can you talk about that? We heard a little bit of how Carl Levin was trying to get some answers out of General Hayden. What can you tell us about that? Was he forthcoming with those kinds of answers, or did Democrats...
He was forthcoming with some additional details about how this whole thing works. He insisted, and he has said some things like this before in public, that the program, the targeting of individuals for this terror screening program, whatever they call it, is done by experts on Al-Qaeda at NSA, not by political people, not even by him, you know, not by signals intelligence experts, by the terrorism experts at NSA. Moreover, he said that NSA keeps what he called a targeting folder on every, I guess, individual or group that they're targeting, and that the Inspector General of NSA and even the Justice Department comes in periodically and looks at these folders, which include justifications for who's being targeted and why, and, you know, what kind of information they're picking up. And, you know, so these outside auditors or somewhat outside auditors allegedly come in and review these folders to make sure that the whole thing is legit. So he's trying to build a picture of a program that isn't out of control, a program that's very tightly focused, and a program that, you know, is very useful and is only directed, he insists, against terrorist suspects.
He talked about needed reforms and acknowledged intelligence failures leading up to the war. What did he? Was he specific about what has to happen to avoid those kinds of errors in the future?
Well, he sort of talked about the need for making clear the caveats on intelligence, making clear the limits of intelligence, making clear what they know, making clear what they think they know, and making clear what they don't know. And these are not entirely new concepts, but, you know, he sort of repeated this stuff. He also had, at least in a diplomatic way, a go at the Pentagon under Rumsfeld, and particularly under Rumsfeld associate Douglas Feith, one of the architects of the war, who set up his own intelligence unit, very small intelligence unit, to try and find evidence of connections between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and he said that he didn't really think very much of their work.
So he was referring to a sort of effort to cherry-pick intelligence almost to make a case
right,
for the war?
He also said that NSA came under heavy pressure, which is something I didn't know before, and I've covered this pretty closely, before the war to come up with intelligence linking Saddam to Iran, to al-Qaeda, and he also said that when they sent over this intelligence, they put on some sort of label saying, warning, we don't know whether this is true or not.
Well,
that's pretty good stuff.
Interesting, because, I mean, one of the concerns raised is General Hayden, of course, still in uniform. The question is he going to be his own man or answering to Donald Rumsfeld? It sounds like he's beginning to answer those questions.
Well, moreover, I mean, you know, the story in the intelligence community is that he's not exactly one of Rumsfeld's favorites. So, and he did talk about at least some disagreements with Cambone and Rumsfeld, Cambone being the intelligence chief at the Pentagon.
Now, what does General Hayden want to do with the CIA? What's his vision for the agency? Did he get into any particulars there?
No, I think he wants to clean it up and make it more efficient after the disastrous brief reign of Portugal. Yeah, but he didn't really call Portugal disaster.
I see. So what happens next? They're going to go into closed session, and do we have any idea of the kinds of questions that he's going to face?
I think he's going to face very detailed questioning about particularly the NSA terrorist screening program. Also, maybe stuff about the recent upheavals at the CIA, which is in a state of considerable disarray due to the recent ousting of Portugal and the questionable management that Portugal conducted when he ran the agency.
Let me ask you this finally, and that is, you know, General Hayden, as we mentioned, very involved with intelligence leading up to 9/11 and after. And in as much as 9/11 has been described as a massive intelligence failure, to what extent does some of that responsibility fall at the feet of General Hayden? I mean, does he have to answer those kinds of questions?
Well, he may have to answer those questions, but remember, you know, there's a lot of people who have to answer those questions. There are a lot of balls were dropped, as it were. A lot of dots weren't connected. I think NSA was perhaps one of the less culpable institutions there because their analysis and their dot-connecting capabilities are somewhat limited. So, I mean, he has to answer questions for the future about that. I don't know that he's going to have to answer too many retrospective questions about that. The 9/11 issues have been pretty well covered by congressional investigations and, of course, the 9/11 Commission.
Okay. Mark, thanks for joining us this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Very, very good to have you. Mark Hosenball is investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He joined us from just outside the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing room in Washington. And we turn now to William Arkin, a military analyst and former Army intelligence officer who now writes the Early Warning blog for the Washington Post. And William Arkin, good to have you with us.
Thanks to have me.
You've been listening in on the Hayden hearings and to Mark Hosenball just now. What are your initial thoughts?
Well, nobody really expected that Mike Hayden wasn't going to do a good job today in his defense of himself and in answering questions. And at least in open session, I think that the general can also rely upon, I don't even mean it as an excuse, but rely upon classified information in not answering some of these outstanding issues. I guess when I see General Hayden undergoing a grilling today, I see it sort of as a two-pronged problem. One is that he is there because the Congress of the United States has failed to resolve the issue of the legality of NSA's warrantless surveillance, something which it has been known about since December. And second, the Bush administration has failed to convey to the American public at large in a broad way the legality and the propriety of these programs. And so in a way, Mike Hayden is taking the heat for the failure of a lot of other people as well.
So you think, I mean, I've read in your blog and I've read some of the other stuff that you've written, you think he has obviously a pretty good chance of sailing through, but it sounds like what you're saying, that if this nomination is in trouble, it's because of the groundwork that, in a sense, was prepared before he got there by the Bush administration.
Well, I certainly believe that. Look, if you're talking about Mike Hayden in comparison to either Porter Goss or George Tenet, I'd take him any day. And I think that he is not only an intelligence professional, but he is also a military man, and as such will be in a better position to direct the CIA than either of the two previous directors. So I don't buy for a minute any of the arguments that somehow he's going to be Rumsfeld's lapdog. But I do think that there are a lot of issues that do implicate Mike Hayden and his directorship at the NSA.
Such as?
Well, the fact that 9/11 occurred while it was on his watch. The fact that the Iraqi WMD occurred while he was the director of the NSA. And though it's true, as Mark Hosenbaum said, that the 9/11 Commission and others have looked into these matters, it is also true that NSA, more than any other agency of the U.S. intelligence community, has not been evaluated. It has skated by. It is barely mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. And what NSA does and its influence in overall intelligence is a mystery to most Americans, and therefore his tenure at NSA may not be the basis for his directorship at the CIA. I think he will make a good director. I think that it is silly for people to imagine that Mother Teresa or somebody else is going to be appointed as the CIA director if Mike Hayden isn't confirmed. But the truth of the matter is that he was a key figure in the intelligence establishment from 9/11 to the present. And his views on the subject, his actions relating to that subject, what he knows and what he suggests as reform as a result of that experience is not being discussed.
Interesting. What does that word mean in this context? I mean, reform is about as overused in Washington as incompetence, I guess, might be the only other word that can compete with that. But what does he mean? I mean, what has to happen at CIA in terms of reform that General Hayden can actually do?
Well, I guess if I were a senator and I were grilling Mike Hayden today, one of the things I would say is, General Hayden, the Bush administration has been in office now for 5 years. Are you telling me that we've done nothing in those 5 years to already change what needs to be changed at the CIA to ensure that it is more capable of doing its job? And so to me, when I hear reform, I agree with you. It is one of those overused Washington notions. But clearly when George Tenet was finally unseated at the CIA, one of the longest serving CIA directors in history, there was a clear sense that the agency needed to be knocked around a bit, both on the analytics side and on the operations side. And Porter Goss failed to do that, and that's why his tenure was so short. And now Mike Hayden is given the responsibility to finally make the changes that everyone perceives are necessary after 9/11.
So that's going to be his big challenge. William Arkin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
William Arkin is a military analyst and author of the Early Warning blog for The Washington Post. He's a former Army intelligence officer. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. There's more coming up here and now. Border region between Yuma, Arizona, and Mexico today, as the Senate continues to debate a major overhaul of the nation's immigration laws. The president is hoping to shore up support for his plan to deploy National Guard troops to slow the flow of illegal immigrants into the U.S. The immigration challenge is dramatically illustrated in the city of Yuma, where U.S. border authorities apprehend up to 450 people a day. That challenge has prompted Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County in Arizona to take some controversial steps on his own. Sheriff Arpaio has set up a 250-member volunteer posse to round up and imprison those trying to sneak into his county from Mexico. Sheriff Arpaio, whose website calls him the toughest cop in America, makes inmates wear pink underwear and puts them to work in chain gangs. So far, he's arrested more than 150 people, and he says he has the right to mobilize the posse thanks to a state law passed in August that makes smuggling humans and drugs a felony in Arizona. And Sheriff Arpaio joins us on the line from Arizona. Welcome, Sheriff.
Thank you very much.
Tell us right off, if you would, why the posse is necessary.
Well, we do have a new law. I'm the only one enforcing that felony law to arrest the illegals along with the smuggler. So, by the way, we have arrested 170 so far, and they're now in the county jail. Let me say this. I've had a posse since I took office. I built it up to 3,000. We use a posse to go after hookers and deadbeat parents and patrol crime-ridden areas. I'm just using part of my posse now to go after illegals. It's a big area. We have 9,200 square miles. So this is just another posse operation, and my posse are not vigilantes. They're well-trained. Those that carry guns go through 180 hours. So it's a great resource, free to taxpayers. They furnish their own guns and airplanes, jeeps, what have you.
Now, they're volunteers, correct?
They're all volunteers, and under the Constitution, only the sheriff can swear in private citizens for the posse, and they have law enforcement authority once I mobilize them.
Now, you're using a state law, but let me just ask you about that law, because my understanding, and what I've read, is that that state law would apply to ringleaders, that is, people who organize the illegal transporting of illegal immigrants into the U.S. You're actually using that state law to go after and arrest and imprison the illegal immigrants themselves.
That's correct. There's nothing in that law that says just the smugglers. But when you conspire with a criminal, you can be arrested also, whether it's drug traffic or what have you. So these people that we arrest have conspired with a smuggler to pay money and that type of thing, and that's what I'm basing my arrests on.
Now, not everybody is happy with what you're doing. Immigrant rights groups and attorneys representing the Mexican government say you've overstepped your authority by arresting these people and charging them under the smuggling law rather than turning them over to U.S. border authorities.
Well, everybody else turns them over so they can get a free ride back to Mexico in an air-conditioned bus. I'm giving them a free ride to the county jail, which I run, which includes almost 2,000 tents. So I don't care what the critics say. I was a director, lived in Mexico City, and covered the whole border with the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. Plus, I was head of DEA in Texas and Arizona. I know a little about the border. I'm a little concerned why Mexico has taken an interest in laws in the United States and criticizing me. I'm the elected sheriff in this county. I'm going to do what I feel is right for the people.
I respect that, but aren't you in effect taking over the job of the U.S. Border Patrol and U.S. Customs officials? Is that really your role?
I'm just enforcing a state law. There's a state law, and I'm here to enforce all the laws, and I'm doing it. I don't care about the federal government. In fact, I'm helping the federal government. If you don't like it, take away the state law.
Now, does your county have the infrastructure, the budget, the resources to carry out this task?
Well, our meals are like 15 cents a meal. That's 30 cents a day. I have tents which are free, almost 2,000. I don't want to complain. Everybody else complains there's no room, overcrowded, it costs money. This is a big issue. So, no, I have no problem. And you know what? I'll put tents up from here to Mexico. I'm not going to use no room in jail as an excuse for not enforcing the law.
You sound like a frustrated man. I mean, you could find people that could debate with you whether this is the appropriate use of your resources, but I think nobody would debate the fact that you sound like you represent the level of frustration out there around this immigration issue.
No, not really. I go after every crook. I'm an equal opportunity enforcer. I don't just pick on this one. My history will show how I run this organization. So I just feel that I have a job to do. Yeah, I have passion for my job. I'm elected, and I want to serve the people and protect them. And now this is just another operation we're doing. Tomorrow there'll be another problem.
Sheriff, I read that the attorney from your county wrote a letter of complaint to U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice about the challenge you're facing in Arizona. What did he tell her?
Well, this is my county attorney wrote a letter and basically said that Mexico should not be involved in interfering with our judicial system and this law and my operation and his prosecution. And they ought to worry about Mexico. Don't worry about what we're doing here. It's not right to do that. So that was basically what he was talking about.
How long do you think you're going to have to keep this up?
Well, it's not that I have to. I don't even have to do this because everybody else, under the same circumstances, all other law enforcement in the state, turn them over to immigration for a free ride back to Mexico. So I don't have to arrest these people. I determine what the policies are, but I feel it's very important to enforce that new felony law. And as I say, I'm the elected sheriff. I report only to the people. I make the decision. They're going to jail for violating the law. I do have compassion for the Mexican people having worked over there, but I'm torn. I'm torn doing my job that I feel is right and the compassion. So I'm going to lean towards doing the job, and I'm going to keep doing this every night and day. We're out there, and we're going to keep arresting these illegals that violate this new state law. It's very simple.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He's sheriff of Maricopa County in Arizona. He joined us on the phone from near Yuma, Arizona. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the story of the Brown Brothers of Rhode Island. One was a slave trader, the other an abolitionist. Both were founders of Brown University in Providence. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced.
Some of the fiercest fighting since the Taliban fell from power 5 years ago. U.S. military officials say more than 100 people have been killed in a series of battles and suicide attacks in the last 2 days. Among the dead, at least 87 militants, a Canadian soldier, and an American civilian. The violence is flaring up as NATO prepares to take over security operations from the U.S. from the U.S.-led coalition in Afghanistan. It also follows a recent trip to Kabul by two Massachusetts women whose husbands were killed in the 9/11 attacks. Susan Reddick and Patty Quigley are raising money for women widowed by war in Afghanistan. And this was their first chance to meet some of the people benefiting from the assistance. Susan Reddick joins us now in the studio to talk about her trip. And welcome, Susan.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. And Susan, when you and Patty lost your husbands, David Reddick and Patrick Quigley, both of you were pregnant. You formed a bond with each other, and you ended up founding the Beyond the 11th organization to help widows in Afghanistan. Tell us what the organization does.
Our mission is to help widows affected by war and terrorism in Afghanistan, both to help on a humanitarian level, but also to raise awareness here in the United States and around the world that these women, they're really in dire need, and we don't want the spotlight to leave this region of the world, because without support from around the world, things are just going to transition right back to where they were prior to 9/11.
Well, I want to talk about those dire needs that you mentioned, but first, let me just ask about your decision to set up this organization. You and Patty Quigley were dealing with your own grief. Why did you think that this was important to do at that point in your life?
Immediately after finding out that my husband David was killed, the level of support that I received was just immediate and enormous. And when the United States began to prepare to invade Afghanistan, I was just so struck by the images that I saw on TV of the life of women in Afghanistan. And I remember specifically thinking one day, you know, if it's so terrible to be a woman in Afghanistan, what must it be like to be a widow? Mm. And so my initial idea was, if I could help one woman so that she didn't have to worry financially about, you know, getting food in her children's stomachs and being able to send them to school and all the regular things that we still, no matter how, not to minimize how tragic the situation was here in the United States, my kids still went to the same schools. I live in the same house. I still was a whole person. I just had something, you know, a piece of me missing. Mm. And so I mentioned my idea to Patty about trying to reach out to help another widow. And she quickly came on board. And, you know, as things evolve, one woman has since become 500 women.
Now, I understand to date you've raised about $325,000, and you went to Afghanistan to see if the money you raised was doing any good. What did you find?
We've given grants to three different organizations, CARE International, Women for Women International, and Arzu Rugs. We went with CARE, and we had a real opportunity to see the specific way in which our money was used. For CARE, for example, we gave a grant for a poultry rearing program where women get a certain number of chickens, chicken feed for 3 months, use of an incubator, medical knowledge so that they can keep their chicks healthy. And we were able to meet not only the women in the program and to see how this program has truly changed their lives, because they now have an opportunity to have these eggs, which they can sell, which becomes, empowering for them to have some sort of income, as well as to provide protein for themselves and their children.
I understand that you met a woman in Afghanistan named Sahira, and she said she never wanted to remarry, and this story shed some light on the struggles Afghan women face. Can you talk about her a little bit?
She knew that if she were to get married again, she would not have the independence that she would as a single person, that the husband would then be able to make the decisions for her and her children, which means that they wouldn't necessarily be able to send their girls to school. Their freedoms would be completely taken from them. Hmm. And it just goes back to the point that women are not valued the way men are in Afghanistan. And it's a horrible thing as, an American, where we have so many freedoms. It was just really difficult to watch. Yeah. I mean, the whole image of these women in burqas, it didn't really hit me until we were over there that the men are truly trying to just make the women disappear and become invisible. They're all one. And that was tough.
Eye-opening for you.
Very eye-opening.
Now, you also met a woman who lost her husband and daughter in an American bombing, yet she said she was still grateful for the U.S. for getting rid of the Taliban.
Yeah, we were surprised by her answer when we asked about what she thought about America. And, the general response was the oppression under the Taliban was so great and people suffered so much that even though she lost her husband and her daughter actually was hit by a bomb and still has shrapnel in her face and in her chest and is deformed and is blind as a result, and there's not only if she had enough money, which she doesn't, but she was saying that there are no facilities in Afghanistan to even help her daughter. But I think she seemed to understand that it was for the good of the whole, that even though they were caught in the crossfire, and trust me, she, we cried so much together and she grieves every day for what she's lost. She understands that the Taliban really did need to be removed, and they are grateful in Afghanistan for the United States to come in. And as an American, I have to say, I was really glad to hear that response.
Well, now that you're back from Afghanistan, what are your plans and the goals for the organization beyond the 11th?
Well, we're definitely re-energized. Not that I ever wasn't energized, but to see and meet these women and to know that we are truly affecting them is so, it's hard to even put into words. I mean, I could start crying right now. I just think that it is so important that we continue to raise money for these women and to tell everybody about their needs, because I think it is so easy, even being back for 1.5 days, it's so easy to get comfortable back in your own life and to begin to take things for granted again. But every woman that we went to visit lived in a one-room house with no running water, no electricity, not a stick of furniture. You know, the children we saw napping on the floor, it was just in a little corner with nothing. They literally have nothing. Mm. And, the difference between making a $50 donation and a $75 donation is enormous, in that $25 for a woman that has very little chance of earning income is enormous.
That's Susan Reddick, whose husband died in the 9/11 attacks. She's co-founder of Beyond the 11th, which raises money for widows in Afghanistan, and she just returned from Kabul. The group's fundraiser bike ride from Ground Zero in New York City to Boston Common is this September. For more information, visit our website, here-now.org. Still to come, the Da Vinci Code opens tomorrow. Question is, how do you get people who might take offense at its content to buy a ticket? we look at how Sony Pictures is marketing the film to religious conservatives. You're listening to Here and Now. The horse racing quest for the second jewel in the Triple Crown moves to Maryland as Kentucky Derby winner Barbaro will gallop on at the Preakness this Saturday. Here with the preview and to talk more about what's going on in the world of sports is Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Hi, Bill. Good to have you.
Hey, Anthony.
Hey, now listen, only 9 horses are scheduled to run this race. Why such a small field?
Well, the people who own thoroughbred horses share a big dream, and the name of that dream is the Kentucky Derby. Mm-hmm. And so everybody who has a chance to get to the Kentucky Derby tries to do it, every horse who qualifies, and that's why that field is so big. But the Kentucky Derby each year teaches many of these dreamers that their horses aren't as fast as they thought they were, and so relatively few of them try to win the Preakness, and hence the small field.
Well, based on the way Barbaro galloped away with it at the Kentucky Derby, I'm surprised that he's not the only horse showing up for the Preakness. Is he really that good?
Well, he's very good. He's that good until some other horse proves that he isn't. And the horse most likely to do that is Brother Derek, who was the favorite in the Kentucky Derby, got a lousy post position way out number 18, had to spend most of the race trying to get to a point where he could, you know, even travel with the leaders. He's going off at 3-1 in the Preakness, and lots of people feel that, that in fact, Brother Derek is the horse to beat.
All right. Well, let's talk briefly about the NBA. Last year's NBA finalists, the Detroit Pistons in the East, the San Antonio Spurs in the West, were thought to be favorites to return this year, but both teams facing big challenges. The Pistons lost last night at home to the new hot team, the Cleveland Cavaliers, with the league's newest superstar, LeBron James. What's worthy of note about all this?
Well, you've stolen my thunder because LeBron James is what's worthy of note.
Well, tell us why.
I'm being a little silly, a little facetious. LeBron has had a much better supporting cast than he's had in the past. The other thing is that Cleveland is playing loose. Cleveland is playing like a team that has nothing to lose and everything to gain. And Detroit, at some crucial parts of this very close series, has played tight and played as if they're trying not to lose. And so far, that's been the difference.
All right, that's the NBA. I want to talk to you a little bit about Barry Bonds, who is stuck one shy of Babe Ruth's mark of 714 home runs. And Bill, I know Barry Bonds probably took steroids, apparently lied about it, not known to be the bubbliest, warmest guy on the planet. But I have to say, I find it disturbing the abuse this man has taken, not only from fans, but apparently from opposing pitchers as well.
Well, as Kurt Vonnegut once said, nobody deserves to have bombs dropped on them. And it's fair to say that nobody deserves to have a fastball thrown behind his ear.
Yeah,
with you in that regard.
Yeah, we're talking about Russ Springer, who threw inside, who threw behind him, and then hit him only to be cheered by the fans. I mean, this is ugly stuff.
It was, and unfortunately, it probably isn't over. There's been a lot of ugly stuff for Barry Bonds, beginning with the opening road series this season, where somebody threw a syringe, absent the needle, happily, onto the field at him when he was running back into the dugout. On the other hand, and though I do agree with you, he doesn't deserve much of the most vile abuse that has come his way. A great deal of what Bonds' problems are of his own making. And so, you know, this is sometimes what happens when you disillusion the multitudes.
Well, I guess, you know, just to play devil's advocate, I agree with you, but it seems like, although much of what Bonds finds himself involved with is of his own making, it's also true that Major League Baseball sort of turned a blind eye to what was obviously a problem for a long time. So Bonds seems to be symptomatic of what was going on in the sport, and therefore, again, I find it hard to accept all this abuse that he takes.
Commissioners before Mr. Selig made a career of turning a blind eye to anything that might, you know, in some way besmirch their reputation and the reputation of the game. So you're right. There's plenty of blame to go around.
And what happens when he finally does pass Ruth's record, that asterisk? What do you make of that?
He becomes the guy who's hit the second most home runs. Never before has there been such a brouhaha about a man moving into second place, in this case, second place behind Henry Aaron. But it's Barry Bonds, and that's what we've seen.
All right, Bill Littlefield, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the week in sports with Only a Game host Bill Littlefield, who joins us each week. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. opens nationwide. And if this is the first you've heard about it, then you probably live in a cave. The film stars Tom Hanks as Harvard professor Robert Langdon, who was called in by police investigating a murder. The police are bewildered by the mysterious markings on the victim's body.
This is a symbol for Venus. It represents the female half of all three.
You're telling me that Sonia's last act on Earth was to draw a goddess symbol on his chest? Why?
Captain Fash, obviously I can't tell you why.
The film, like the best-selling book by Dan Brown that it's based on, is fiction, but it's ruffling some very real feathers of the faithful. A former Vatican official called for a boycott of the movie, and there have been protests by Catholics in both India and Thailand. Among the explosive topics of Dan Brown's novel, that Jesus married Mary Magdalene, that they had children, that the Catholic Church covered that fact up, and that one of the chief villains is a member of Opus Dei, which Brown characterizes as a nefarious cult within the Catholic Church. So how do you get those who might take offense to the film to come and see it? In this week's New Yorker magazine, staff writer Peter Boyer looks at how Sony Pictures aims to do that. They took a page from Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. Here and Now's Deborah Becker asked Boyer if Sony even realized it was dealing with such controversial material when it signed on to do The Da Vinci Code.
I think the answer is really a kind of blind spot. Of course, everybody at Sony knew that that's what the book was about, but there really wasn't a question of did it matter. I mean, on one level, they said to themselves, well, it's just a novel. It's not like we're doing a nonfiction account of the history of Christianity. But also, there was just not a lot of attention paid to a possible backlash. The culture, the media culture, certainly the Hollywood culture, was not yet attuned to, you know, the Passion of the Christ phenomenon.
And so then when The Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson's movie in 2004, came out, and the way that that controversy was handled was really what changed things here for this movie, and that's what you write about in the New Yorker article. Can you explain that a little bit?
I can. Sure, Sony, as the rest of Hollywood, noticed this remarkable phenomenon of Mel Gibson's film. It was a project that was pretty widely scorned by Hollywood. The secular press, as you will recall, just roundly lambasted the effort. I mean, it was called Christian pornography and a terrible movie and all of that, but it had the curious effect of uniting devout Roman Catholics and Protestant evangelicals who came to see Mel Gibson, this Hollywood actor and director, as one of their own, as somehow standing on their side of the culture divide. And you know what happened. I mean, people flooded to the theaters. The churches bought tickets in blocks. Some theaters were sold out for days and even weeks. And it did $370 million in domestic box office, which is the sort of noise to which Hollywood attends.
Mm. And so what you're saying then is that Mel Gibson's movie really made Hollywood sort of stand up and take notice of this market, which it may not have done before.
Yes, that's right. The faith market became sort of a hot market segment. But there was also a caution and a concern and an interest in the power of this segment. I mean, it was just 8 or 9 months after The Passion of the Christ came out that George W. Bush was reelected president over Hollywood's candidate. It was pretty clear that, you know, Christian values played one way or another, played a part in it. And Hollywood, for all of its pretensions to progressive politics and all of that, does have many fingers always in the wind. And as a result, you know, being able to market or to at least handle the Christian segment became a real priority on Hollywood.
And so when you compare and you go move now from Gibson's Passion of the Christ film to The Da Vinci Code, what lessons do you think they took from Mel Gibson's movie and they're applying to The Da Vinci Code, and that's where you see the parallels here?
Well, I think that Sony Pictures, you know, didn't think it could ever pass off The Da Vinci Code as some sort of religious film that would appeal to Christians. But what it did was pretty smart, slightly cynical, and really smart. Their strategy involved, first of all, hiring a public relations outfit out in L.A. called Citric & Company, whose specialty is reputation management. And I think Sony really was concerned not to have this project and that studio associated with an anti-Christian jihad somehow. That certainly wasn't what they intended in buying this book. And the second piece of it was they decided it would be much better to have Christians sort of in the tent, to paraphrase LBJ, rather than outside sort of screaming in. What they did was invite Christian leaders, opinion makers, to participate in what was, at its heart, a marketing effort, but what was posed as a discussion of the issues raised by this novel and by the film. They paid a Christian marketer to set up a website that would engage Christians in the issues, you know, whether Jesus was married, and did it matter if Jesus was married, and did the Catholic Church really do these things. Of course, they basically debunked all of the assertions in the book, but it had the effect of sort of setting a theme for the Christian reaction to this movie. And the theme was engage the questions raised by the book and by the movie rather than standing apart from it and just saying, don't see this film, it's evil or it's bad.
But I'm wondering, the folks who would be offended by this, would they buy that?
Remarkably, yes, they did buy it. 2-3 dozen very prominent and important thinkers and scholars participated in this project, writing essays, very, very calmly addressing some of the assertions that were raised by Dan Brown in his book. Opus Dei, which of course has a lot at stake, considered suing Dan Brown and suing Sony, and decided at the end of the day to sort of follow the theme of engagement and revamped its website and used it as what they call a teaching moment, sort of set the record straight. And strangely enough, that seems to have worked for Opus Dei. I mean, they've gotten several million hits at their website and a lot of new recruits.
So do you think that all of this and Sony's efforts here to try to direct the debate, do you think it's going to help sales, or what do you think is going to be the deciding factor here about whether the Da Vinci Code is ultimately a success?
I think what it's going to do is not hurt sales, possibly actually help sales in the sense that countless churches across the land are going to be sermonizing on the Da Vinci Code and holding classroom discussions and so on. But the most important thing is it's not going to hurt, and that was sort of what they were worried about. I think while it will almost certainly open huge, you know, over 100 million, probably over 125 million, the question is, you know, what legs it will show and whether that will carry over into a really, really sort of mega hit. And that depends much more than on the criticism or on the church or anything else. That depends on the movie itself.
New York staff writer Peter Boyer speaking to Here and Now's Deborah Becker. His article, Hollywood Heresy, appears in this week's issue. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Special thanks to Jim Babb at the Boston University Film Production Services. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.